The opinions expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WICR management or ownership.
It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
And welcome, everybody. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, your curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And you are listening to She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And today we're going to be talking about the challenges with engineering large public art sculptures and also the capacity of local artists to respond to these challenges. Your questions are welcome, as always. The number to call, 317-788-3314. Mark, we've got another full house in here again today. Plenty of guests.
Definitely
and a,
do.
And a substitute host at one point in the show today. So listeners, buckle in. Why don't you introduce everybody, Mark?
I will. With us is Chip Doden, who is a mechanical engineer. Welcome, Chip.
Thank you.
Hi, Chip.
And we've got Julia Moore, who's with the Arts Council of Indianapolis.
Hi.
Hi, Julia.
And David Landis, a sculptor. And hi, David.
Hi, David.
Hi.
And then guesting for me partway through because I have to run to an event that Julia is going to join me with where we have a call for artists. But I've got Ben Ayers with me.
Hello.
So when your voice switches halfway through, you'll know.
You'll know what's going on.
But we really wanted to talk about the complications of, it's not just engineering, but the science behind when we are talking about doing art installations. And everybody thinks that you can just do things, like you can go just paint a wall, which, Julia, you've been doing a lot of lately with great places that I love on the sides of the oil change places and
the
all
Jiffy
around.
The Jiffy Lube project,
right.
Yeah.
And then underpasses and all that. And then people think, you know, you could just put some paint on that wall. So I don't think that works as well. And Chip, the reason we had you here was I'm really curious. Recently you had a project, a task that was assigned to you to make something, a mechanical cricket sound. Can you talk about how difficult that is?
Yeah, that's right. So I was asked to make a mechanical cricket sound for a sculpture, a big cricket sculpture. Looks really, really cool. But we started playing with some different media to make that, and it sounds pretty straightforward. Everybody knows exactly what a cricket sounds like, but to translate that from our world into, you know, hearing what the insect world hears is very difficult. So we started with some ball bearings crashing together to see if we could make some chirping noises, and we did in fact make those chirping noises, but we weren't finding any consistency with those. So we started rubbing some pieces together, plastic, sounded okay, but in the end, we're actually still working on it. So if anybody has any suggestions, we are definitely open to ideas on how to make cricket sounds with normal objects.
That's great.
But before that even happens, Julia, you're kind of the first person in this group here because your job is public art, identifying what it is, where it can go, how it gets funded, how it gets taken care of, how you bring in the sculptor like David and the mechanic like Chip and
yep.
make it all happen.
Yep, that's my job.
So for people maybe who aren't totally sure what is public art, what is it, and how do you start that? How do you figure out where it should go?
Well, you know, I think we have to start by distinguishing between public art and art in public places. Mm-hmm. You know, and
that's
art,
a very, yes.
You know, and art in public places is something that you think of when there is, you know, a large metal something in a plaza or a some kind of a statue and somewhere else. But I think there's a very big distinction because public art really speaks to the public a little bit more directly. It talks to what people are thinking, what people are feeling. It's very much community directed. And art in public places, I think, has a little bit of that remove. And it's really not at a human scale. It's really more on the civic scale. And
like Monument Circle.
Exactly.
That is
That art. Is an art in public place. In public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, you know, thinking about that and, you know, yeah, I'm very well, I've done both. You know, I've worked with art in public places, but I've also worked with actual public art that's really very much concerned with what people are thinking and how they live their lives on a daily basis and how to express that through art in the public spaces that we all share.
And so when somebody wants to put public, create public art, they come mm-hmm. to you guys and what happens
yeah.
then?
It really depends. It depends on if they already have the money together, you know, and if it, or if there's a fundraising campaign that has to happen. Sometimes they need to get an artist and a design associated with the project in order to raise the money. And sometimes they already have an artist with them and they just need a little bit of help just actually with the design process and making sure, you know, figuring out what they can do. So, you know, the Arts Council comes in at really any point in that process. And one of the things I love about my job is that literally every single project is different. I have never duplicated a process. I have never duplicated an owner. I have never duplicated an artist, really. And even if I do duplicate any of those, the other things that are involved in it, the site, it all makes it completely different. So you're literally reinventing the wheel with every piece. And I love that.
And I love that part of what you do because each one of those, you're also helping artists at a mm-hmm. different level to build their capacity
Absolutely.
To do certain things. And so being the Arts Council of Indianapolis, you're trying to encourage artists who may not have thought that they could do something as large as they're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And this is where we bring in the experts because, you know, an artist can't be expected to know everything, and especially an artist who is doing something at a certain scale for the first time. And we usually look to pair them with the design talent, whether it's an engineer, a landscape architect, something. And then also the fabrication talent, because, you know, some artists can physically make everything themselves, and some artists rely on fabricators to do that, and they need help finding the right fabricator for the design that they have in their head.
And David, as a sculptor, when yeah. it comes to something like that, it's like a whole new ball game for you, too, if you've been asked to create something, depending on what your original work was.
It's an interesting adventure. Mm-hmm. It's a different creature from just being an artist sitting in a studio thinking of an idea. And I come at this through my experience. Really, when I speak with artists, I try to help artists understand their value and what they're bringing to this effort, understanding the financial implications of the whole process. And then speaking or helping the artists understand how to communicate their value to the community or the stakeholders, whoever they may be. And then helping the stakeholders understand the value of the artist, because what often happens is it's a struggle when you're entering into this as an artist to make it financially viable. Mm. As much as we as artists love to produce art and share our art and be a vibrant part of the conversation in our community, it still needs to be, in some form or fashion, a perpetuating process. And so there's lots of details behind that you have to think through that I really didn't understand as I began the process of trying to discover or explore what does it mean to be an artist that has larger scale art, whether that's public or private.
Yeah, and I think a key part of that, and Julia and I, we've talked about this before, that the idea that we also need to have dollars available for prototyping and testing for artists, and that's the harder one to come by because everybody wants the final commission, and we can raise money for that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times we haven't worked out how it's going to work yet or even mm-hmm. look, and so that's a really missing hole, I think, sometimes in our
unless
art
you've got something that's reproducible that you've already done, a prototype that's already it's a proven concept, because an idea is an idea,
yeah, right?
And you don't know where it's going to go, and you're not sure, and then you have the stakeholders and the environment and all the other external factors, and then as an artist you've got the production factors and can you fabricate this yourself, or you know, what are going to be the implications of long-term exposure and environments? And just what I'm excited about this conversation, why I'm glad you guys are having it, is because it is a larger, it's a much larger thing than most understand. Mm-hmm. And if we can just begin to inform and educate and share what it's like to be an artist on the other side, we drive through our city and we see beautiful things that are holding a space. They're holding a space for us as community members for beauty, holding a space to dream or experiment or whatever we bring to it to remember. It's an important part of our community, mm-hmm. but there is so much that goes into the process and so much behind the process that we all need to understand and remember as we work through the process.
And Chip, go ahead.
It takes a lot longer than people understand.
Yeah. Well, because like you said, you got to bring in a lot of people, and someone like Chip as an engineer, I mean, you have to really get in there and be honest with an artist about whether or not it could really yep. work or not.
No, that's right. And I think David touched on this a bit. One of the first things you kind of start to realize when you go through the process of wanting to get a piece out in actual public space is how many working pieces there actually are. And so you can have a concept of, I want this kind of art piece on this corner of this space, and you don't realize there's a lot of nuts and bolts that go into that. There's a lot of fabrication work that goes into that. There's a lot of time and material expenses that when you think about these in your head, and I struggle with this as an engineer. So when you think about these things in your head and what they're gonna look like in the end, it's easy to start to get so into the idea that you sort of forget a lot of the details. And I think that that's one of the places where I like to at least try to fill in some gaps of, you know, understanding we need to go back and look at every single part that's actually gonna go into this piece of work and understand what it does, how it interacts with the rest of the work, and how we can all bring it all together.
And that engineering isn't necessarily just mechanical parts. It can be like murals and understanding
right.
materials, just mm-hmm. materials in general.
That's right.
And Julie, has that process changed over the course of years from when people thought, oh, let's just put some art out here kind of thing, to now, to where people really step back and make it a longer, more intensive process before it actually happens?
No, it's always been that way. Yeah. You just never hear about it. It was just magic before. It's always been. And the story that I like to tell is that it took over 40 years for the Soldiers and Sailors Monument from beginning idea to actual finishing it. Because of, you know, in the beginning, a lot of sort of community factors, mm-hmm. and then the artistic factors, and then the building and the structural factor, the engineering of it, and then the fabrication of it. It takes a really, really long time. And that's a very big piece. But, you know, even so, you know, I try to get everybody's expectations up front, you know, because they describe to me what they want. And I don't try to talk them out of it, but I'm trying to say, okay, now, so first of all, here's what you say your budget is, here's what you say you want. Here's the gap.
Yeah.
And then to try and tell them, so it's like, okay, you either have to find more money or scale down what you're expecting for the money that you have. And then we go through that process. But, you know, I tell everybody, if you want a three-dimensional sculpture taking up, you know, lots of physical space, it's at least a year. I like to say a year and a half, and 2 years is very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And some projects, if it's integrated into architecture, it's much, much longer. I was the project manager for the public art at the Indianapolis Airport, and mm-hmm. that was 40 years. So,
and it's beautiful now, but you're right, but there's so much involved in
that. Yeah, there's so much that goes into when we talk about the place itself. And you're talking about understanding place from the type of culture, the people that live there, but you're also talking about the place from what's happening there, the weather, the materials that are there, that thing. And I recall in my mind that we had done a bunch of the traffic signal boxes around town, and a couple of our artists were really smart, and they had put a coating over mm-hmm. the artwork that would allow the graffiti that went on be removed without mm-hmm. removing the coating, that without removing the artwork.
Yes.
Which no one would think about was what happens to protect something.
So yeah, the materials technology, I would say the materials technology has come a long way. There are a lot more choices now, and I think you spend a lot more time really trying to understand, you know, what's going on in that place. Do you have a graffiti problem? You know, what's the traffic pattern? Is this something, is this corner, if you put something there, is it likely to get hit because of the way things, and you know, you also have to think about, all right, you're spending a certain amount of money, what's it going to look like in the future, you know? And if it has
AKA
to be...
AKA and dancing.
Yes, exactly. You know, but, you know, the maintenance of the physical piece, but the street around it, you know, what's are they going to reroute the street? If they need to move it a little bit, how does it come apart? And this is the engineering aspect of it because, you know, in a lot of the pieces that I do, I always ask the artist, all right, so if it has to be taken apart and moved... or refabricated, you have to let us know how that happened. We have to have a diagram. We have to have a map. We have to know how it goes together, even though we're not anticipating taking it apart. We need to know how it went together and if it can be taken apart. And we spend a lot of time with three-dimensional works in particular understanding how it's made.
And that's what I... am friends with another artist or interacting with another artist, connected with another artist over the internet, who I happened to ask him a question about the mechanics of his sculpture that was here in Indianapolis. And the curators of the sculpture itself found out that I had the schematic for the structure. They were like grateful because they didn't have the understanding of how it went together, so they could take it apart to do maintenance. And it was just a local person doing maintenance on an unknown that... So, yeah, there's a lot more to it. And that's, when we as artists can begin to understand for ourselves the complexities of it, it's not something to stop us, it's just something to understand and something to take into our practice and our understanding of our business. Mm-hmm. And if we want to, frequently we as artists get excited about producing art that we've been envisioning and dreaming about and putting our heart and soul into, and then we forget the other side of it, the other side of helping others understand the value of it and then ourselves understanding the value of it and what it's going to cost us. So it's just to make it sustainable for ourselves.
Well, I think one of the things is that you end up on that line is that you end up thinking about things in a different way as an artist, and particularly when you get into kinetic art. Or things that people want to interact with the art. So I can make a sculpture last for a very long time if it doesn't do anything.
Yes.
Right? Because we know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's out there and it's doing that. But when we get to something that people want to interact, like Anne or something else, then we have to think about its life. And so I'm out of the museum world. I'm always thinking about the lifespan of something. And we always say everything is semi-permanent. Because you can't really plan to be maintaining things for years to come that are in motion or have light. Chip, you were going
to
say something.
Yeah, just to speak to the idea of reproducibility. You know, we had an incident with one of our art pieces, and we needed to rebuild it and are in the process of rebuilding it. And part of what I think comes to the table with the engineering side of it is we had all of the documentation existed. So it's all in the 3D world in CAD space, and all the fabrication prints still exist. So it's been pretty easy to work from, you know, this sculpture getting destroyed to then recreating it, actually making some changes that make it better and getting it back out into the public space. And so I think there is an aspect to this that you know, it's nice to have that documentation piece and to have that idea that maybe I'm not going to be able to have this sit here for 20 years in its current state, and I need to think about what it looks like in 5 years.
Yeah, and even with that, what you found in the process of doing it still takes, like Julia was saying, even when you have the plans, the fabrication and the work of doing that still takes a long time. It's taken us a year to get re-engineered a whole piece from scratch. So, you know, it's hard for people to understand, well, you just replace it. Well, it was a long time to make it.
Well, and here's a great example, Anne Dancing, because it was produced 20 years ago. Is that how long it was?
No, almost.
Almost. And at the time, Did anybody think about what it would be like in 20 years, 25
no.
years?
And because the Ann Dancing box was developed for a temporary exhibition that was only supposed to last about a year.
Okay.
And so then the idea of taking that box, which was fabricated for this temporary exhibition because we paid the output for it and we have this thing, let's figure out what we do. And then the idea of commissioning Julian Opie to do a new piece because it's all digital for the box that housed it, and then placing the box on the cultural trail, you know, was just like, well, we have this piece of infrastructure. It's stupid not to use it. And so they used it. And then, but the idea that, okay, it then ages, and it's out in the weather for much, much longer, and it's in a different location, and it's doing a piece that is expected. I mean, I think a temporary piece, I think people have certain expectations of, but when the expectation of permanence and the, you know, using digital works and the expectation of permanence for digital works is really almost a contradiction in terms. So it was never really engineered as robustly as it needed to be.
Because I think that's enough. This is the image of the woman swaying back and forth, if somebody hasn't seen this before, down there on Mass Ave. And so when the GoFundMe campaign was created and the amount that it was going to take to just to save it, and then money on top of that to rebuild it, to, I think people were kind of aghast at first, because
yeah, yeah.
The normal public doesn't think about that. Yeah.
It costs a lot more to fix it than to actually get it in the first place.
It's like, wow, how did that happen?
And that happens. That happens a lot.
Sure.
That
yeah.
happens a lot. Things do deteriorate, and one of the things that we as public art administrators are looking at more and more is when we commission a piece, we define what its useful life is.
Yeah.
And we say, all right, based on what it is, where it's going to be, how it's made, we figure that this is going to last for 20 years or 10 years or however many years. And then we organize everything that we do around that. So you make choice. If you're expecting something to last for 50 or 100 years, you make certain choices. If it's only going to last 25 years, you make certain other choices. And this is where we love our experts, we love our fabricators, we love our engineers, we love our conservators that help us make those choices.
Yeah.
And then, because someone's got to be responsible for it. Someone's got to keep it in good working order. And you also have to think about who's going to be around to be responsible for it in 50, 100 years. And if you don't know, then you go, all right, we can't make that commitment to this piece physically for that long. And then there's a legal aspect as far as artists' rights, so the artist has to be on board. And I know artists like David always want their pieces to last absolutely forever.
That's always the vision.
It's the legacy.
It's never going to die.
But sometimes it doesn't. And for me, that's my job, is to have that conversation with them and going, you know, this is how what we can realistically, and it depends. Is it a neighborhood that's commissioning it, or is it the city that has a lot more resources? And you make these choices and you have these conversations. And again, this is what takes up a lot of the time for public art, is to have and to think about the answers to these and consult the community and get back together.
And this is where the artist needs to have a comprehension of their business. I mean, a lot of artists don't necessarily consider their work a business, but if they want to continue and they don't necessarily have the resources to do the art, not as their primary source of income, this is a business that they need to consider all the factors that are going to go into that the stakeholders need. But the part that I think we as artists are need to improve is our understanding of, first, our worth and our value as artists and what we provide or contribute to the community. Helping, as I mentioned earlier, holding a space. Whatever that physical space is that art is in, it is providing different things to different people. Even if we don't, our dancing lady, I've heard very wide-ranging opinions of her. But it's, if I don't understand it, at least it's creating a, it's holding a space of entertainment, of beauty, of conversation, of community. Even if we don't agree in this world, I think artists can be a part of the conversation, of bringing us together to communicate and understand each other and see that some people find beauty in certain things and others don't. And it makes our world that much richer. And if we as artists can begin to understand and more clearly communicate that to the community, it all of a sudden allows the stakeholders to understand the value, which then needs to be invested to promote the project.
Exactly. It's David Landis. He is our sculptor in studio with us today. Julia Moore here with the Arts Council of Indianapolis, and Chip Doden, our engineer. And we are obviously talking about public art and the challenges to that. We're going to take a short break. Your questions are welcome, 317-788-3314. And then we'll be back with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Grab your platform shoes and bell bottoms and head to Connor Prairie for a tribute to ABBA. Tonight, Kroger Symphony on the Prairie. One of the greatest pop groups of all time.
We're having a good time so far.
The music of ABBA spanned from the early 70s to the early 80s. The sounds of ABBA. Tonight, Kroger Symphony on the Prairie.
Mamma mia, it's a game we play. Bye bye.
A tribute to the best of ABBA. Tickets are on sale now at IndianapolisSymphony.org. Local Kroger locations or call 317-639-4300. Don't forget, Symphony on the Prairie is BYOB.
Congratulations to WICR's Jazz Artist of the Month for August, Karina Corradini. We're honored to have this jazz vocalist sit down with us to talk about her greatest musical inspirations, her move from Buenos Aires, Argentina to Los Angeles, California, and of course her debut recording album, Bridge to Infinity, a tribute to Zane Musa. You can listen to Karina's conversation with us online at WICRonline.org.
Hello again, I'm Joe Girard, your host for Inside Great American Music. And as you know by now, we're here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Diamond 88.7 WICR. Our show revolves around the Great American Songbook, and this week, part one of three parts, the Italian crooners. This week we feature Sinatra, Jerry Vale, and Frankie Lane. So join us this Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Diamond WICR.
And welcome back to She Says Art and He Says Science. I'm Jill Dittmeyer. Mark Kiesling had to step out to go to a meeting about establishing art. And Ben Ayers is going to sit in here with us and co-host a little bit here for us. Thanks, Ben.
I will do my best to make Mark proud.
Oh, you will. And we've got David, Chip, and Julia here. We're having a great conversation about this. And as we were on the way out of before the break, we were talking about kind of the legacy of things and establishing something that's going to last forever. And this kind of brings to mind the mural, one of the first ones in the city by Roland Hobart, that many people were aware of way back then, and then it's kind of literally faded away. But there's a resurgence to bring it back again. And Julia, this is it's a pretty important piece that maybe a lot of people aren't aware of.
Yeah, it's a really important piece. It's from 1973. It was the first contemporary style commissioned mural in the city of Indianapolis, and it was part of a larger effort to try and bring people back into the core of the city by fixing up areas that where, for example, there was used to be a building right there that came down, it was derelict, it was removed, and then it left this big hole, and the mural kind of fixed up that hole and made that area a little bit more attractive. And to understand, you know, what that does on a civic scale, but then art being used as a way to make spaces more people-friendly and more attractive. And again, you know, understanding how long and figuring out how long it's supposed to last. In 1973, paint technology was nowhere near what it is right now. We have paints, we have coatings, we have additives, we have all kinds of things. And if we want to, we can, I don't think we can make a painting last 50 years, a mural, but we can, you know, we can definitely make it last 25. And, you know, normally we assume that murals are only going to last in, you know, as look as good as when they went up for about 10 years, and then you have to really start taking care of them. The coatings that you've put on have weathered away, the paints fade, all kinds of things can happen. And then you start thinking about, well, you know, not just the physical nature of it, but the emotional nature mm-hmm. of it. So, you know, has whatever was going on at that time, whether it's prevailing aesthetics or why it was put up in the first place, is it still valid? So there's the physical longevity and the conceptual longevity. And I think that mural, you know, if you look at it, that is like a definite 70s super graphic. I mean, you can tell looking at it exactly when it was put up. And I think it sort of falls, you know, a lot of people go, you know, they weren't too sad about it going away, because the moment where those kinds of colors and shapes were popular has fallen away. But, you know, it's back, just like everything else. You know, so again, that's the whole design aspect of it, is like, how long is it supposed to last, and how of the moment should it be if it's supposed to last forever, because you don't want it to visually date either.
No, but it's also a great, as David pointed out, a wonderful conversation starter, because if I'm remembering correctly, Richard Lugar was mayor of the city at that time.
Yes.
And he brought that in, and it was kind of a revolutionary thing to to kind of resurrect the downtown Indianapolis city a little bit. The Lugar Plaza that's now been named for him mm-hmm. is right across the street from mm-hmm. it now, too. So there is kind of this reach from the past to the present thing that I think is really maybe worth saving, just for the history aspect of, and the conversation aspect of it as well.
I think so, too. And I think if we can't come to terms with our past, how are we going to move mm-hmm. into the future? And that mural represented a lot of effort by a lot of people and a lot of meaning for a lot of people. And if we think about the city as it is today, the roots of who we are as a city really started with that mural, that idea that cities matter.
That's very true.
Mm-hmm. But is that also part of appreciation of public art, where obviously if you go to a gallery or you go to a museum, that's its own experience to look at art or to appreciate art. But if you have something you've seen just for a second every day on your way to work or lunch or something like that, and then that becomes a part of your life, and is that also a reason to preserve it? I mean,
it is. And people, you never know how the bonds that someone are going to make with their environment. And it can be something really, really simple, like it could be with the people that ride your bus on that day. You know, it's familiar. It's part of your morning. It's part of, you know, and or it could be something that you pass, or it could be, I know when I was a kid, there was always this curve that we used to round, and I knew I was almost home. And so I called it in my head the almost home curve. And, you know, people form, and you know what? And I don't think the engineers who planned that street knew that it was going to have that kind of meaning mm-hmm. to, you know, a little girl in suburban Washington, D.C. But it does, and it did.
And I think that's the beauty of art in general. We don't know all the implications. We have an idea if we're creating something. It doesn't matter whether it's a visual art or even an author or whatever form of communication. We don't know how it's going to land with those that we're communicating with.
Right.
And go ahead.
Which that leads me to a project that has been going on for some time on the East 10th Street. The kind of the community was greatly involved in talking about what kind of public art they would like to see in that community. I know that was an Arts Council outreach project, Julia.
We've been involved. The Arts Council has been involved on the Near East Side probably since before the Super Bowl. So it's been a while. It's been, you know, at least 10 years on a regular basis. And the idea of arts on East 10th Street and on the Near East Side has been part of that conversation for a long time. And we've done a number of things over there, from very small things to very large things and some planning things. And, you know, now I'm involved. Actually, I'm on the team that's helped plan the revision of the streetscape on mm-hmm. 10th Street. So I'm there kind of in my art head talking to them about things like that, art and community and opportunities and things like that. So things happen. Things do continue to plan all the time, and that necessity for involving the community in all those conversations to understand what that meaning is going to be is vitally, vitally important.
Yeah, and I think that's what's kind of been, that's maybe the new resurgence type of thing that I especially have seen with that is making sure the community is involved and the artist is involved too, right. David, like you were saying, that right. everybody's in there from the very beginning. And with technology, the engineer, everybody has to be at that table from the get-go almost at this point.
And going back to what you were talking about, being in the community and whether the life of a project, again, I think it's we often begin to take things for granted that we see on a regular basis. They just become part of the background, unless it holds a very special meaning. And all of this conversation and any conversation we can have about this subject helps us all to understand how to live with art. I mean, I have art on my own walls, and my relationship with why did I buy it, and who was the artist that created it, and how did they create it, and why did they create it? I just think it's another level of depth and richness and beauty and joy added to our lives that, again, we as artists bring and are participating in bringing to the community. And we just, this idea of appreciating and bringing attention to is can't be understated, I don't think.
Well, there's going to be a way for people to see and kind of hear art and a lot of different aspects. It really is going to involve a lot of technology, engineering, and daily life with the Red Line. And I know, because I know art is a big part of that, that many people think it's just a transportation system, but it's really not. There's a really many more levels to it, isn't there, Julia?
Yes, absolutely. Anytime your people are interacting in public, you know, they're creating levels of meaning, and really it's the artist's job to understand what meaning people are bringing to these public spaces and to try and express that, whether it's historical or contemporary. And the Red Line, I've been involved with the Red Line for a long time, and we did a project starting in 2017 and mostly in 2018 to involve artists in thinking about the Red Line and to stage temporary projects to help people kind of bridge that, you know, here's how transportation used to be in Indianapolis and here's how transportation is now. It's a big change, but I think art can absolutely help do that. And it can do it with humor, it can do it with information, it can do it with beauty. Reasons having to do with the federal funding for the Red Line, we couldn't integrate art into the stations immediately, but after that project is all wrapped up with a bow on it, we're going to go back and we actually designed the station so that parts can be swapped out and turned into art as things go. And again, we worked very, very carefully with the engineers yeah. for those particular buildings to make that happen.
Yeah, I would think, Chip, I mean, this is like, to me, that's like the ultimate engineering example where engineering becomes art. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Truly.
You know, that's where I really appreciate involvement with Mark and what he does and kind of trying to bring, you know, art to life through science and engineering and interactivity and having it in places where people are going to want to stop and spend some time with a piece and, you know, touch it, feel it, hear it, all of those things. So, yeah, I agree that the engineering aspect of it is really, really exciting, and it's fun to be involved with as an engineer, because this is stuff you don't typically get to do in your normal day-to-day life as an engineer.
And it's fun to be in a conversation. Chip and I have done some work together. It's fun to be in that conversation as an artist and begin to see things from a different side of just the engineering aspects of it. So it begins to inform my process of creation. And so I can kind of adjust what I was thinking, but now from that last conversation we had, I need to do it this way, and kind of it's a collaboration in a lot of ways.
Likewise, you know, I take a very pragmatic approach to what I'm doing with the art piece, and you know, David's taught me to look at things even more spiritually. That you know, these art pieces have a lot of spirit behind them, and a lot of ways to connect to them that aren't just necessarily pushing buttons or listening to sounds or, you know, just interacting with it, that you can see it and understand some spirit behind it.
And what point does it go from the inspiration for the art to the need for it to be functional? Does that come with collaboration? Is that one of the earlier thoughts?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you know, the connection between this is my idea, but can we get it to work and to function? Is that an early thought or does that come later?
I'd like to think it's early.
Well, the practicalities of it. I mean, if I'm sitting in my studio by myself and creating what I want to create, I don't need to concern myself. But if it's going to go out in the world, and I'm concerned about that, and if that truly is part of why I create art, is to be part of a conversation, to be in a conversation, to create a conversation, then yeah, we have to have exposure and experience with others that are involved, stakeholders or people that can contribute to the project.
And I think too, the connection back to sort of the fabrication world is not always a straightforward connection. And one of the things that we found in one of the pieces we worked with the Da Vinci Pursuit was we needed a fairly complicated plastic panel built, which on paper looked pretty easy. Yeah. But when you go to talk to the fabricators, they're all telling you, no, this isn't easy at all. This
can't
is going to cost, yeah, exactly. This is going to cost five times your budget for the entire project. And so just trying to create or to connect with more creative fabricators is even an area where, you know, you have to have some involvement early on to say, can we go and actually make this thing that's in our heads and it's even on paper? Can we make it a reality for the budget we're looking at, the scope, the scale we're looking at?
This conversation about collaboration and conversation and the spirituality and thinking at larger scale or from a larger perspective, I think we as artists, what I appreciate about Da Vinci and what Da Vinci has brought to the community and to my practice is bringing this into the community, not just as an art piece, or not just with a specific objective in mind, but to begin a conversation about people's own experience of their own lives. And it's not, for me, it's not necessarily just about the piece, the creation, whatever is holding the space, but it's a conversation starter about what's possible for the people that are observing it, what's possible for the community, and how can they begin to dream, and how can they begin to participate in that inspiration process, because we're all creative, whether we realize it or not. We're all using our imagination, and inspiration happens to each of us. And when art can participate in eliciting that from other people and providing a space, a way for people to access that, it just adds that much more depth to the process.
Well, and I think there's been studies shown, and I know the Arts Council has statistics on this, that neighborhoods that have art or appreciate the beauty in their neighborhood, people are more likely to take care of it. They're less likely to commit crime. They're mm-hmm. more likely to be nice to each other. I mean,
yeah,
it solves a lot of long-term problems.
And
honestly,
place attachment, more and more people are really understanding that the more closely you are attached to a place, the more benefits it has on your head, not just on the civic level, but on a personal mm-hmm. level, your mental health, your physical health. They've done studies about people being released from prison and going back to neighborhoods where they have place attachment versus not place attachment. And if they go to a place where they don't have that place attachment, they're a lot more likely to reoffend. So there's a lot of things mm-hmm. that have to do, and that's one of the things that I love about public art, is because public art and place attachment, you know, because it is so caught up in place, it can help create and it can help express that level of place attachment.
And in the long run could help solve some big problems that we're battling with crime and poverty and that type of thing too.
Yeah, honestly, it does. It does. And I think it's the collaboration between the community and the artist is really mm-hmm. important. I see a lot of times that communities see artists as just kind of a pair of hands and they go, all right, so we want this and you go off and make it, you know, without understanding that, you know, the artist has a lot of things mm-hmm. that they bring to the table as well, you know, such as relationships, such as if they are from the neighborhood, they've got their own perspective. If they're not from the neighborhood, they can bring in things from other places that they are familiar with, and they can help not just sort of answer the questions and do what the neighborhood says, but they can ask questions that's going to make the piece a lot richer. And the neighborhood is going to get something that they never knew that they wanted because of this conversation.
And that takes the artist standing, knowing and believing and understanding the value that they're bringing. And that's what I'm talking about, that value is we don't go to the physician and ask the physician or tell the physician how they're going to take care of us. We inform and we participate. But the artist brings a perspective that they practice. And artists often talk about practice. Part of that is their perspective and how they see the world. And it can be a starting point for more conversation and something unexpected.
Does it start with a theme of a certain place, or does it start with an artist coming with an idea, or both? Is there a standard way where these things begin?
It could be both. With neighborhood work, I like to say that the neighborhood has to invite the artist in. If an artist is just saying, I have a great idea that goes right here, and if they're not from the neighborhood, that's a recipe for trouble right there, you know, because they've, you know, and again, if it's a neighborhood that's under-resourced or has experienced a lot of trauma, it can end up re-traumatizing that entire neighborhood. So I always say, you know, I want whoever is hosting the piece to be the initiator. Now, they don't have to have a design in their head. They might say, have come as a community to the realization, you know what, this place is really important for XYZ reason. I think we need to have an art piece that's going to express that. How do we get that happening? And that, at that point, that's where they usually reach out to me. They've had some conversations among themselves. They don't necessarily know how to reach out to an artist. They may have had some design thoughts in their head. Some of them, you know, are, you know, maybe okay. Some of them maybe, you know, maybe not, you know, maybe needs a little bit of refinement. But at that point, I mean, it's usually easy for me to tell whether they're far enough along in those conversations to start involving an artist, or if some of those conversations need to continue to happen. So I can have those conversations with them. I can facilitate that in a number of ways. Or if I say, yeah, you know what, I think you're ready to start talking to an artist, we start figuring out what that means. And then you start talking about budget. You start talking about the nature of the place. Sometimes the place where they want to put it, they don't own it. That's owned by somebody else. Mm-hmm. And you need to have those conversations to go, can we even put something here? And, you know, there are a lot of moving parts that way.
Well, and that kind of brings up, too, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, the Jiffy Lube, the business, they have sponsored a series of murals that they've had painted on their buildings throughout the city and everything. So there is like a real, it's a private business, but it's a public viewing space.
Yes.
So that's like you're walking a fine little line there.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, people do get very proprietary of the space they see, even if they know they don't own it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they can get, and that's, again, that is a very fine line that we have to talk to. And it really is place by place. Some places are like perfectly happy to go, you know, whatever you do here, it's something different. Wonderful. And some places are like, you know, we're really preparatory about our neighborhood. And, you know, I've worked, done this long enough in the city that I know which neighborhoods I'm going to go, all right, so we have to really work very closely with the neighborhood association and the neighboring property owners. And then some places it's like, eh. And the thing with Jiffy Lubes is that because they're on these commercial strips, you know, like Keystone Avenue or US 31, they're kind of like, people understand that these are kind of no place places. They're commercial. They're owned by the businesses that are on them are the ones that kind of give it their character. And they don't really expect to have much of a say in what goes on in those places. And one of the reasons the Jiffy Lube murals are so exciting is that they bring that sense of personality and that sense of life to these places that are otherwise just, you know, kind of, you know, chain place dead zones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been a really successful project, and I believe the Indiana's is maybe they're kind of an example for the rest of the Jiffy Lubes across the country.
Yeah, they are. It's you know, this is my second year with the Jiffy Lube program, and they have said when they go, because it's a franchisee that does that, and he goes to the national, you know, the convention of all the Jiffy Lube franchisees, and around the country, business is down, except for Indiana, except for his, and he doesn't own every single Jiffy Lube in Indiana, but the ones that he owns, he's up. And he goes, it's because of the murals. I mean, you got to give people something more. And yeah, he does other things too in the nature of his business. But the public art is something that people can go, oh my God, this makes this different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to reward that difference with my business.
Gives you something to look at while you're waiting on your oil change too, which is a good thing. We're going to take another short break, and then we're going to be back here with more conversation about public art. Your questions are welcome at 317-788-3314. We'll be right back.
Where can you find this summer's tastiest food? Head to the Indiana State Fair and American Dairy Association Indiana's famous and fabulous dairy bar. From August 2nd through the 18th, we'll be serving all of your undeniably dairy delights, like scrumptious grilled cheese sandwiches, thirst-quenching ice-cold milk, huge ice cream cones, our rich and creamy signature milkshakes, nutritious and delicious kids' meals, and more. And be sure to celebrate your visit to the fair with this year's brand new dairy bar treats, the caramel coffee milkshake, and the Hoosier Hometown Hash Grilled Cheese, an incredible taste sensation featuring four cheese varieties delectably melted between two crispy hash brown patties. The Dairy Bar, it's a state fair tradition. We're on Main Street opposite the Coliseum, and we're open every morning at 7.
This message brought to you by American Dairy Association Indiana, your Hoosier Dairy Farm families. Every single day, dairy delivers for you.
Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
There's a real troubadour tradition in the folk music world. Singers going out, gathering the songs and stories they hear, and then sharing them with anyone who wants to listen. Well, that's the tradition the Small Glories honored on their new recording. Hey, I'm Elena C., and this week, I'll share an exclusive session with the Small Glories. Hope you can join me right here on Folk Alley.
Join us for Folk Alley, Sunday nights at 9.
And welcome back to She Says Art and He Says Science. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and our special co-host for this half hour is Ben Ayers.
Hello.
Good to have you here, Ben. We're joined in studio by Chip, Julia, and David, and we are talking about the challenges with engineering large public art sculptures and the capacity of local artists to respond to these challenges. And David, I know one of the projects that you've been working on for a long time, and thanks to a wonderful anonymous donor to the Da Vinci Pursuit is going to help possibly finish it, is a project that involves water. So let's, and this is a piece that will be viewable to the public.
Uh-huh.
So this kind of encompasses everything that we've been talking about all hour long.
And it kind of, it leads back to the different ways an artist can come to a project, whether a community or an interested party comes to the artist, or the artist is in the general public and somebody sees a piece. And as an artist, I kind of come at it that way. That's just my sensibility or how I've been working. And so this project and the Da Vinci Pursuit helping me to get that piece out into the world is a wonderful thing. And it's, and donors, patrons, however someone sees themselves, are very valuable and important part of the process. And I can't thank them enough for what they're contributing to my project. And I know when you were talking about artists and their capacity, this is a process. It's a practice. It's a developing a skill set and an understanding and a way of working that begins maybe at the beginning and it gets shaped by engineers and other interested parties. But it's such a larger thing than sitting and producing a piece that you're just going to look at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And to have the resources or the opportunity to expand that and to develop something larger is great.
And at this point with your project, because we've talked about this project before on the show, mm-hmm. too, you've had time to build it and kind of adapt it and figure work with the engineering to get it in the water, and Chip can speak to this more.
It's in his ballpark, but I've developed the initial prototype thanks to the funding from the mm-hmm. Da Vinci Pursuit. And then that has... We've gone through several fabricators and people and considering environment and where it's going to live. It's a piece, for those that aren't familiar with what we're talking about, the canal in Broad Ripple is what was the impetus for this idea, and specifically the waterway in Broad Ripple, and I'm interested in kinetic sculpture. And that waterway is an engineered waterway that is an integral part of our community. And so... I, as an artist, was thinking, how can I bring that unseen or that unobserved or
taken for granted element of our community, that waterway, and transfer and bring it to life. So I developed a underwater paddle wheel and mechanism to bring that power up out of the water and to run a sculpture to motivate a sculpture
that will actually sit on the water. And hence, you need
an
engineer.
So that's why we need an engineer to begin to work on issues that, back at the beginning, yeah. I was thinking, this is a cool idea, and then implications of where it's going to land is.
This is an interesting one to me because normally when I get a piece of work or something that I'm going to be working on, it's kind of handed to me, and you know, I'm told, go right now. We need this, however, 6 months. And on this one, you know, we kind of had to wait a little bit for the funding to come through. So in my head, I've already redesigned this piece probably 5 or 6 times.
Fabulous. Great. We worked through a lot of
false
starts.
Yep. But yeah, it has been an interesting piece because David did such a great job with the engineering in the first place. We really don't have to go back and rework much other than some material spots and you know, some places where we can probably gain some efficiency.
Right.
In the way that it's driven and make sure that it stands up in the water and to the elements and everything like that, make sure it floats, obviously. But for the most part, I mean, it's a well-designed piece from the beginning. So my part of it is almost as much spectator and,
you know,
enjoying
David's imagination
as being able to provide some input.
It's a dance back and forth, and where we're at with the project is it works. The general gross aspects of it work, but there's a lot of finer details that we just don't know. I don't, for example, it's going to be floating on the waterway. I don't know what it's going to weigh, depending on what its fabrication weight is once we get done, and other implications.
And are you to the point where you know where it's going to be? Has it been approved?
No.
Or is that
it has not.
You haven't had the meeting with Julia yet.
I'm speaking into the void and believing that it's going to happen.
We're going to pull a Pat McAfee and just put
just
it in
put
the
it
canal.
In the canal. Well, most don't know, but I've already tested the paddle wheel on the waterway.
And it works.
And it works.
But Julia, so when you do hear about a project like this, they've obviously done the research and the collaborative efforts on it. In your mind, do you start thinking where this might really look good, work well, and add to?
I do, yeah. Most of the work that I've done, I hardly ever have a piece where an artist has kind of initiated it, mm-hmm. and it's like, and then comes
it's
to
the
me
other
and
way
goes.
Around.
Where can this go?
Yeah.
You know, it's usually the other way around. It's usually the community kind of comes up with the desire for it, and then we go out and search for the artist. Yeah. But sometimes, yeah, it does happen. And because I'm out in the community every day, if I know that a community is very, very interested in their waterway and is very, very interested in having that, I can make that match.
So that's a good thing. So
yeah. And that's, again, I cannot overstate, this is a different aspect. This is a different way of working as an artist,
right.
Public art and larger scale art, and funding and research and the development process is integral to what might happen, what we might be capable of creating.
That we hope it will. Julia, very quickly, you literally this morning were out giving a public tour of art on your bike, and I know there's a few more of those that people can learn about. Where
yes,
can they find out about
absolutely.
Those?
Absolutely. They can find out about it on our website, indiearts.org. And just go to public art and current projects, and you'll see the bike tours.
I know we've got pictures of your art on our website, David, mm-hmm. but you have a website as well?
DavidLandisStudio.com and PlayingWithPossible.com.
Chip, anything you want to plug?
Just the Da Vinci Pursuit. Go out there and see their work.
Thank you. Thank you, Chip, Julia, David, for being here. Ben, for sitting in and filling in for Mark while he runs off to another thing this afternoon. And as I mentioned, you can see pictures of all these projects and our other guests on our website, thedavincipursuit.com. And until next week, I'm Jill Dittmeyer. Mark Kiesling is out and about.
I'm Ben Ayers.
And we are reminding you all to stay curious. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.
Hello, I'm Michael Toulouse of Classical Music Indie. As a host on 88.7 WICR, it's my pleasure to share a little information with you. The details, like Mozart's money troubles, Beethoven's ambition, Vivaldi's showmanship, that make the music come alive. But the greater pleasure by far is sharing the music itself. Share it with me here on A Different Kind of Public Radio.
Listen tomorrow morning from 6 to 10 on 88.7 WICR.
Monday evenings here on WICR, you can tune into the Owl Music Group radio show hosted by local jazz musician Kenny Phelps. Kenny presents interviews with local and national artists as they travel through the Indianapolis area. He features their music and spotlights agencies that produce change in and around our communities. That's the Owl Music Group radio show on Mondays at 9 p.m. on WICR The Diamond.
Broadcasting from the University of Indianapolis, this is 88.7 The Diamond, WICR-FM and HD1 Indianapolis.
This encore episode of the UIndy Faculty Artist Series was produced by Classical Music Indy. You can find more information about Classical Music Indy at Classical.